This is Hillbilly Solid, and I'm your host, Silas House. Just heard a new song from Scott Miller's brand new album, Big Big World. That's called Freight Train Love, Stonewall Heart. I can't recommend that album enough. It's one of Scott Miller's all-time best, and he's had quite a few great ones. We are glad that you're joining us here on Listener Supported Radio. This is Hillbilly Solid. I'm your host, Silas House. We have a great show lined up for you today with lots of good music, and a really special guest we have coming later in the show, Eric Reese. He's the author of Lost Mountain and American Gospel, and most recently, two new books, The Embattled Wilderness, which he co-authored with James J. Krupa, and also a book that he edited called The Guy Davenport Reader. We're going to talk to him about those new books and all of his work, and really looking forward to having him in the studio here in a few minutes. But let's get into the music. We'll start off with a song from my brand new album by Tim O'Brien and Daryl Scott. It's a cause for celebration when those two put out an album together. Their last one together was called Real Time, and it came out 13 years ago. So they have finally put together a follow-up, and it features some really great songwriting from both of them. And here's one of the best ones on there that takes a really complex and new sort of look at a really divisive and important issue that we need to all be thinking about. Here is Keep Your Dirty Lights On.
Well, my daddy came from coal dust, and me, I'm about the same. If you read King Cole's ledger book, then you've seen my family name. It used to take a camp of miners to load their train and go. Now there's four in my crew, and we do what we do to keep your dirty lights on. Keep your dirty lights on. Keep your dirty lights on. If you got money in your pocket and a switch on the wall, we'll keep your dirty lights on. Well, Daddy worked in darkness, me in broad daylight. I'd blow a whole seam like Daddy never dreamed, using Nobel's dynamite. As long as there's coal in them mountains, we're gonna burn it up till it's gone. Well, we can't stop blowing mountain tops. We gotta keep your dirty lights on. Yeah, keep your dirty lights on. Keep your dirty lights on. If you got money in your pocket and a switch on the wall, we'll keep your dirty lights on, yeah. Every time they have elections, they talk how coal is clean. Well, coal is cheap, but coal's still black. It ain't never turning green. So plug your electric car in, charge it good and strong, and do your shopping online. We'll get you every time, just to keep your dirty lights on. Keep your dirty lights on. Keep your dirty lights on. If you got money in your pocket and a switch on the wall, we'll keep your dirty lights on. Keep your dirty lights on. Keep your dirty lights on. If you got money in your pocket and a switch on the wall, we'll keep your dirty lights on. Keep them on.
All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. The taxi's waiting, he's blowing his horn. Already I'm so lonely. lonesome I could die. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go. There's so many times I've let you down. So many times I've played around. I tell you now, they don't mean a thing. Every place I go, I think of you. Every song I sing for you. When I come back, I'll bring your wedding ring. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go. Now the time has come to leave. One more time, let me kiss you. Then close your eyes, I'll be on my way. Dream about the days to come when I won't have to leave alone. About the times I won't have to say. Oh, kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe,
musician, lay your hands on me. I am your family tree. I know your A to Z. I've got a secret proposition, lay your hands on me. I am your family tree. I know your A to Z. This is a secret proposition, lay your hands on me. Nothing to talk.
You just heard Family Tree. That's from the new Kings of Leon album, Mechanical Bull. If you want a good album just to rock out to, that's definitely a good one. Before that, we heard Leaving on a Jet Plane by My Morning Jacket, covering John Denver, and that's from the John Denver tribute album, The Music Is You. And we started off that set with a new track from Tim O'Brien and Daryl Scott's new album, Memories and Moments, and that song was called Keep Your Dirty Lights On. Let's get right back into it here on Listener Supported Radio. Thanks for listening to WUKY. Thanks for listening to Hillbilly Solid. Let's start back with one from the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. Here's That's It.
Last night in Kentucky, neath the beautiful harvest moon. And I was the boy who was lucky, but it all ended too soon. Now I sit here alone in the moonlight. I see your smiling face, and how I long for your embrace and the beautiful Kentucky.
Gonna dig deep down into my heart. There's a world full of joy and mystery. There's a world will be of joy, I believe it will be, when we know what it is to be free. There's a world full of trouble and more. There's a world full of trouble and more.
That was Ruth Moody doing a song called Trouble and Woe from her album These Wilder Things, which I highly recommend. Before that, we had The Kentucky Waltz by Daniel Martin Moore and Jim James. That's from Daniel's new album, Archives. Get you a copy of that one. And we started off that set with That's It from the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, an album of theirs produced by Jim James. He's all over the place. Well, coming up on Hillbilly Solid, we have lots more great music and especially an interview with acclaimed author Eric Reese. We'll be right back.
They say I'm mad.
This week on Joe's Blues, a delightfully scary addition for your instant Halloween party. From Earl King to Buddy Guy, Howlin' Wolf, Tom Waits, Etta James, and Roscoe Holcomb. Plus the Ravens, the Spellbinders, and them. We've got tricks and treats. On Joe's Blues, this Monday evening at a special time, 9 p.m., on 91.3 WUKY.
From NPR Music, it's Arcade Fire Live. This Monday night, hear Arcade Fire perform their new album, Reflector, live from Capitol Studios in Los Angeles. Their album isn't out until Tuesday, but you can hear it for the first time right here on this station in a very special First Listen Live from NPR Music. That's Arcade Fire Live, right here.
Tonight at 10 on 91.3 WUKY.
In today's fast-paced world, there's so much to keep track of. Did you know that you can now take WUKY with you wherever you go? By downloading the WUKY app at WUKY.org, you can listen live, pause, rewind, and listen to any of your favorite shows on demand. Download the WUKY app for your iPhone, iPad, or Droid. It's free from listener-supported radio, WUKY.
Well, howdy. I'm Silas House, and this is Hillbilly Solid. Thank you for listening to us here on WUKY listener-supported radio. So let's hear one from Kim Ritchie's Thorn in My Heart. This one's called Breakaway Speed.
She had to make rain. Once it started falling, it was never the same. 40 days running, 40 nights long. Water kept on coming till the valleys were gone. Gone. She said it's alright. Took me where she left me. Turned around, went away. Said she won't forget me. Turn around, went away. Breakaway speed. Breakaway speed. Would have come running, but I couldn't keep up. She counted all her blessings, but it wasn't enough. They were hiding in the shadows where it's never quite clear. She wants something better that she couldn't. Said she won't forget me. Turn around, went away. Breakaway speed. Breakaway speed.
falls behind the edge of town. She said it's all right, took me where she left me, turned around, went away, breakaway speed. Never looked back, said she won't forget me.
She hadn't left me here to stay. Sitting here singing a song, I'd rather he had taken me along. Somebody I love, I know I'm gonna hate, runs me round in circles. So won't you come back, baby? Won't you come back now? Won't you come back, baby? Won't you come back now? Won't you come back now? You know my head is heavy and my heart feels sick.
Yeah, my head is heavy.
Well, my head is heavy and my heart feels sick, so won't you come back quick? You're my earth and heaven, you're the sun, you're the moon.
You're my earth and heaven, you're my sun and moon.
Yeah, you're my earth and heaven, you're my sun and moon. So won't you come back soon? Won't you come back, baby? Won't you come back now?
Won't you come back, baby? Won't you come back now?
Won't you come back, baby? Won't you come back?
That was Jenny Muldaur and Teddy Thompson doing a song called Come Back Baby. That's from an album called Sing Me the Songs, a tribute to Kate McGarrigle. If you love the McGarrigle sisters, you need to check that one out. And we started off that set with Breakaway Speed from Kim Ritchie's Thorn in My Heart. We are very lucky to have with us on this episode one of our best writers, Eric Reese. Eric is the author of several books, among them one that all Americans should read called Lost Mountain, A Year in the Vanishing Wilderness, which came out in 2006 to wide acclaim, and one of my favorite books, An American Gospel, on Family, History, and the Kingdom of God, which appeared in 2009. In the last few months, Eric has published two more books. They are The Embattled Wilderness, which he co-authored with James J. Krupa, and only a couple of months ago, he released The Guide Davenport Reader, which he edited, and we'll talk about both of those. Eric has been widely published in magazines such as Harper's, The Nation, Oxford American, Orion, and many others. He currently teaches environmental journalism, writing, and literature at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. He lives in the woods out in Nonsuch, Kentucky, with his wife, Melissa. Welcome to Hillbilly Solid.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Great to have you. I'm always interested in what writers were like as children, so I'm wondering if you were a writerly little boy or reader.
Yeah, I was. I was a huge sports nut as a kid. And so me and my best friend, we would, you know, pretend we were reporters and we would watch the games and then we'd write up stories about the games. And we made a little anthology, I think the year that UK won it, you know, back with James Lee and Rick Roby and all those guys. So that was sort of part of it. And I was just a real introverted kid. So I spent a lot of time alone reading and drawing and writing.
Mm. What were the first books that had a major impact on you?
I think probably the Great Brain books.
Yeah.
You know, I can't remember how old I was when I read those. Maybe, I don't know, 9 or 10. Maybe, I don't really remember.
I don't know those books. What were they?
They were books about two brothers, and one of the brothers was this really just precocious older brother who kind of knew everything but was constantly getting into trouble, and the stories were told by his younger brother John, and they were just about a family. The father was a newspaper reporter in a real small little town, and you know, they were just real well-crafted little stories.
So sort of like the Hardy Boys, like a series but more about knowledge, or
more about rural life
and,
but they were, yeah, and I really liked a lot of those Matt Christopher books. Again, those were more about sports, but just about boys growing up.
Right. Can you pinpoint an impetus or a moment that you began to really have a deep care for the environment? Did that happen as a child, or?
Yeah, it did. It happened with my grandfather because he was a country preacher in the Tidewater area of Virginia in Pocosin, and he always had a canoe, and he always had members of his congregation that had boats that they would put at our disposal when I came to visit, and so we would go out fishing and paddling, and that was really the first time I had a real sort of extended experience, you know, just out in the natural world, out on the Chesapeake Bay or in the coves around there, just paddling around my grandfather's kayak or fishing. And so that had a real profound effect on me. And then when I was about 19, I guess, I went to visit him. He had moved to Florida, and we went out in this canoe, and he said, you know, do you want this canoe? It's a buddy's of mine, and I think he'd sell it to you. And I said, yeah, you know, I'd love to have it. So we got back, and I heard him in the back room on the phone saying, well, he's just a poor college student. You know, don't, you know, maybe 50 bucks. So he came out, and the guy sold me the canoe for 50 bucks. And I just sold that canoe at a yard sale last year for 50 bucks. But I spent a lot of time in that canoe, and that's probably how it all kind of got going.
Yeah. Well, how did that, how did that evolve, your interest in the environment?
When I moved to Virginia, I lived right on the James River. And so it evolved just in the kind of slow sort of pastoral sense of just reading Thoreau and, you know, just, you know, the great nature writers and wanting to emulate that kind of nature writing. And that was really my only ambition until I moved back to Kentucky in the early 90s and started spending a lot of time in eastern Kentucky and really being around the strip mining a lot. And that's when I began to realize that, you know, you can't just have that pastoral experience where you celebrate the natural world when that natural world is being destroyed all around you. There has to be a political component to it. And so that's how sort of my nature writing transformed into kind of environmental writing mm-hmm. and advocacy work.
Right. Because Lost Mountain, in a way, is, it's like investigative journalism, but it also has this memoir element, but it's also environmental writing, so it straddles a lot of lines. And American Gospel is like that, too. And
I really wanted it to be a hybrid text. Mm. I didn't want it to just be straight journalism. I wanted to spend a lot of time on the mountain. I wanted to describe the flowers and the wildlife, and I wanted people to really have a sense of this is what it's like to experience this right. place.
Yeah, a student of mine was telling me today that Lost Mountain really changed his life because he was drawn to it because of the flying squirrels. And he just had an interest in flying squirrels, and mm-hmm. somehow that led him to Lost Mountain, and he got this whole education he never knew about. You yeah. never know how you're going to reach right. people, do you?
Right, right. I mean, you know it's going to be through story, though.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, I had a good flying squirrel story, so yeah, I put yeah. it in there.
Right. Well, it worked, don't you? Well, Wendell Berry wrote the foreword for Lost Mountain, and he wrote the foreword for this the new book, The Embattled Wilderness. I know for a fact that Wendell is one of your biggest fans. He's the first one to say that. And so how did that relationship begin?
It really began after I published the article version of Lost Mountain called Death of a Mountain in Harper's. And I had met Wendell a couple times before that, but you know he wouldn't have had any reason to know me. Mm-hmm. And after that came out, we started talking. And that was oddly when my first mentor, Guy Davenport, had just died. And I sort of became friends with Wendell right after that. And so I just consider myself really lucky. I've had these two fantastic mentors right in a row, right at a time where I really needed them the most. Yeah. If I'd met Wendell first, I wouldn't have been ready for what he stood for. You know, I thought I was too cosmopolitan for mm-hmm. that. Yeah. But when I met him, I was really ready, you know, to use any help he could give me.
Right. Well, he's great for that.
I promised him he would never have to write another introduction to a book of mine, but he's you know, he's just so generous.
Yeah, he is. Well, in that most recent book that he wrote the foreword for, The Embattled Wilderness, it's about the Robinson Forest in eastern Kentucky, and it's particularly about your hope that the forest won't be destroyed. Can you tell us what we need to know about the Robinson Forest?
Sure. This is a forest. It was completely logged in the early 20th century by a guy named E.O. Robinson, and he really didn't understand how much coal was there. So when he was finished logging it, he didn't think he had any use for it. And so he just gave it to UK and said, use it for teaching reforestation. UK really didn't even want it. They tried to give it to the Forest Service, but nobody would take it. So 90 years later, what's happened is Robinson Forest has come back as second growth mixed mesophytic forest. It's, you know, it's a wonderfully biologically diverse place. And UK still owns it. It's 14,000 contiguous acres. I take my students there all the time, anywhere from one day to a month. And the unfortunate thing about Robinson Forest is it's almost completely surrounded by strip mining, and it's really the last mother load of coal that hasn't been tapped. And so, I mean, it's really a bullseye for the coal industry. And so there's just always been this fight to mine Robinson Forest, and then a counter force by UK students to save Robinson Forest. And I mean, the students, it's a testament to their, you know, their diligence. I mean, they've always, I mean, so far more or less won these fights and kept the bulldozers mm-hmm. away. There's been some unfortunate logging there, but there hasn't been any strip mining in the main block. And the great environmental lawyer, Tom Fitzgerald, worked to get it designated as land unsuitable for mining, so it would really be hard to overturn that. But there's also about $100 million worth of coal under there. Mm-hmm. So whenever those two forces come together, right. you know, there's always a danger. So Jim and I, my co-author, who's a brilliant naturalist, we wanted to kind of do what Wendell did for the Red River Gorge when he wrote The Unforeseen mm-hmm. Wilderness, and you know, just to make an argument for its preservation. And that's what we set out to do. So Jim wrote, we alternated chapters. Jim wrote the natural history of it, and I sort of wrote the human and political history.
Right. Well, Wendell's book is largely responsible for the preservation of the gorge, wouldn't you say? And so hope this book will have the same.
You know, it's you always hope that. You always hope for a silent spring or a, you know, something like that. So I've heard there may that it may be the freshman reader next year for the for all the freshman classes. So yeah, we'll see what comes of it.
It's, you know, as with all your work, it's very lyrical and, you know, it, you get an education without feeling like you're being educated, which is the best way to get it.
And, I appreciate
and
that.
And I also think it's how seamless it is that you and Jim do, you alternate chapters, if I understand right.
Right.
But it flows, you know, really well, and both of you are very lyrical writers, so it really, really works. I encourage everybody to get a copy of it. It's a beautiful read. Well, and then just a few months ago, the Guy Davenport reader was released, and I know that Guy Davenport's been hugely important to you. What do you want people out there to know about him?
I just don't want them to forget him. I talked to his publisher, Jack Shoemaker, last year, and I said, you know, that guy's been dead for 7 years. Nobody's talking about him. He was, to my thinking, the greatest prose stylist of his generation. I mean, just unmatched. And the problem with his work is that a lot of people find it difficult, and I think a lot of people never give it a chance. They just think, oh, I'm not going to like it or I'm not going to understand it. So one of my one of the things I was trying to do in the reader was to put together a collection that is approachable and accessible, you know, on a lot of levels, and just try to get people sort of interested again in his work, or people who've never, you know, never knew his work, to sort of draw them to it.
Right. Yeah. The people who do know Davenport's work, they talk about him being a genius writer, and yet so many people don't know about him. So it's great that you all managed to put that together. It's a big old tome, but some great stuff in there.
And it's the first time that there's ever been a book that had his fiction, his essays, his poetry, and his translations, and his journals in it. So you can really dip around in it and find something you like. So I hope that'll be the case.
Right, yeah, I hope people will check that out. Well, can you tell us what you're working on these days?
Well, I just spent the summer driving around the eastern United States visiting utopian communities past and present, and I'm writing a book called Utopia Drive, A Road Trip Through America's Most Radical Idea, and that's pretty much what it is. It's an intellectual history of a lot of these really fascinating communities. A lot of them started in the 19th century, like Pleasant Hill Shaker community, and they just stretched all along the eastern United States. And some still are going today, and I've spent some time there as well.
Is Fairhope, Alabama one of those?
I didn't go that far south. I'm sort of focusing more on Shaker Hill up to Oneida, New York.
Okay.
It's not a comprehensive guide to you know, utopianism, but it's sort of a, like Lost Mountain, sort of an experiential kind of
right
book.
Were the ones that existed in Kentucky, did they always have a religious affiliation? Or
they did. I mean, there were a few in the 60s that didn't. But in fact, one of the interesting things is the ones that lasted the longest were always the ones with a religious affiliation. When places like New Harmony, Indiana, began with an anti-religious vibe and just the secular sense that you know, tolerance was enough, there just wasn't a guiding principle or purpose to these communities, and they fell apart pretty quickly. So it's been a lot of fun just doing the research and then visiting them and thinking.
And with the Shakers, there was that whole problem of not reproducing, right?
Well, yes and no, you know, because they were millennialists and they just thought, you know, the second coming was going to happen, you know, just any time. And so they didn't need to reproduce because, Jesus was returning. And then when that didn't happen and industrialism came about, then, you know, of course, they really had a problem. But, you know, they lasted 100 years. People forget that. I mean, to have a completely self-reliant community is, I mean, to produce just the beautiful work they produced. I mean, and it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I know so many people who have never been to Pleasant Hill, you know, who will live really close by, and it's just an amazing place on many levels. Everybody should go there. Well, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit and ask you what the last really great book that you read was.
I'm doing so much reading right now for the Utopia book, but something I'm reading now that I'm really loving is Janet Malcolm's book about Chekhov, where she actually goes to Russia and Yalta and St. Petersburg and tracks down all the places where he lived and he wrote about. It's the kind of writing I really like, where you combine journalism with research and literature.
And a personal, is there a personal element?
Yeah, there's a personal of her journey through these places. Right. So I'm really interested in that right now.
What about music?
You know, I've been playing a lot of that new Matt Duncan Band CD, Soft Time in my truck. Yeah. That's a lot of fun.
And I know you're trying to incorporate some utopian, like, songs that talk about the utopian experience. What have you found along those lines?
Well, there's, of course, Change Is Gonna Come, Sam Cooke. There's Talking Heads' Road to Nowhere, which is kind of whimsical. Stevie Wonder's Saturn. The one that that blows my mind that I really want to write about is Billy Bragg's World Turned Upside Down, which is about Gerard Wynne Stanley and the Diggers, that movement.
I love all his stuff, all the stuff. Well, thank you so much for your good work. You set an example for all of us, and I really appreciate it. I know lots of our listeners out there do as well, and that they really admire you and your book. So thanks for that.
Well, I think you set the example for all of us, so it's great to be on your show.
Oh, well, thank you for being here. We're always glad that all of you have joined us here on Hillbilly Solid. We're going to close the show with another one from Scott Miller's new album, Big, Big World. I'm telling you, this is one album to check out, Big, Big World. This one is called Home. Come back now, and until next time, be good to one another. Here's Scott Miller.
Going home. How many years I've longed to see the mountain so high. Watch the wild geese fly across blue summer sky. Feel the love light shine from my dear mama's eyes. Now I know I'm really going home. Carry me back to East Tennessee, though my body be cold as the snow. Lay me down easy under a tree where only God and I may go. I'll be gone a thousand times more gladly than I ever was here. Take and all doubts and all fears. Perhaps you'll find it in your heart to shed a golden tear when you call my name and find me gone. Carry me back to East Tennessee, though my body be cold as the snow. Lay me down easy under a tree where only